You're listening to the Stephen Wolfram Podcast, an exploration of thoughts and ideas from the founder and CEO of Wolfram Research, creator of Mathematica, and Wolfram Alpha. Coming up, the third installment in a four-part series surveying the history of science dating back to ancient Babylon, recorded live at the Wolfram Summer School at Bentley University. In this next episode, Stephen picks up with Noam Chomsky, Programming Languages, The Work of Einstein, and Space-Time Quantum Mechanics. Let's have a listen.
By the mid-50s, there were starting to be sort of programming language type things. The big thing that happened in the mid-1950s in a piece of convergent evolution in scientific history that I've asked the various people involved in it about, and I still have never really gotten to the bottom of what happened, was 1956. Noam Chomsky wrote his first paper on generative grammar, and Backus and Naur wrote their paper on the formal specification of computer languages. And they're exactly the same idea, basically, of using context-free languages, trees, to represent the grammars of things. The Chomsky stuff, in part, came out of some work by a guy called Zelig Harris, who was his sort of mentor. But in any case, these two things emerged in 1956. And that was the syntactic structuring of computer languages. Then the computer languages, the early computer languages, COBOL, Fortran were early languages. By the late 1950s, there were all kinds of things. Lisp and APL were both invented. John McCarthy had invented Lisp, and Ken Iverson had invented APL. Neither were really used in practice at the time, but they were kind of theoretical languages. Now, meanwhile, this whole idea of universal computation was still sort of a theoretical idea. There had even been another version of universal computation. So a thing that happened after Turing's paper came out in 1936, there had been various other models of computation, in particular lambda calculus due to Alonzo Church. Another thing came a little later, register machines due to a couple of guys in England. But in any case, the big thing that sort of happened was that people gradually said, okay, now we've got, I've got the idea of lambda calculus, I've got the idea of something else. And it turned out all these things were equivalent. So that was sort of a big thing that came to be discovered in the 40s and so on. But no great significance was made out of it. It was just, okay, these are all equivalent. And so there's sort of a fairly robust notion of universal computation. Actually, all these people have been scooped by a guy called Moses Schoenfinkel in 1921 maybe. Moses Schoenfinkel was a student of Hilbert's who invented these things called combinators. And what Schoenfinkel had been trying to do was to do for predicate calculus what Scheffer had done for Boolean algebra. So Scheffer had invented the Scheffer stroke, the NAND operation, had turned all of Boolean algebra into this thing where there was just one operator that you needed to use, not the AND and OR and NOT. And so what Schoenfinkel wanted to do was to do the same thing for predicate logic. And so he came up with this S and K combinators, which could be combined to make sort of any operation like that. And it turns out they're an example of universal computation. Moses Schoenfinkel himself was a bit of a, following, I'm afraid, a long tradition of logicians who have strange human user interfaces, let's say. Schoenfinkel, I tried to track down the history of Schoenfinkel. He did not lead a happy life. He was he spent much of his life in an insane asylum, and he died during in World War II when Moscow was kind of under siege and so on. But he was, strangely, he was probably a friend of Trotsky's. And in fact, strangely enough, the guy who sort of brought combinators to the to public awareness, to the awareness of a lot of people, was a guy called Jean van Hoogenort, who was kind of a mathematician slash communist person who wound up as Trotsky's assistant when Trotsky met his rather unfortunate end with the ice pick and so on. And so that guy, Jean van Hoogenort, put this book together, which included the paper of Schoenfinkel, and that was kind of the time when most people found out about Schoenfinkel's work. So I don't know whether there's a, I've sort of tried to trace this connection. I don't know whether there ultimately was one. Another chap who was involved in this was Haskell Curry, of currying fame, if you know functional programming and so on. Haskell Curry basically got combinators from also studied combinator-like things, but pretty much got them from Schoenfinkel. if he had found Schoenfinkel's paper in a library in Princeton. But in any case, the okay, so now we're in the let's see, where have we got to? We've got to about the 1960s, and the kind of the notion of sort of what does computation you know, what is this thing that we're talking about with computation? And essentially, there had been a quite separate tradition, which was the physics tradition, which wasn't in any way connected. You know, if there was some fundamental way that things worked in terms of computation, it had nothing to do with the way people thought things worked in terms of physics. And physics had kind of had its big moment in the 1920s. Well, in 1915, general relativity was invented by Einstein. In the 1920s, quantum mechanics and then quantum field theory were invented. And then there was a long progression of using mathematical methods to develop both of those theories. General relativity was a very difficult theory to develop. It took really until the 60s, even 70s, before a lot of things that came from general relativity were known. Quantum field theory is also very difficult to develop, very difficult mathematical computations that sort of led in the 40s to things like Feynman diagrams and led to these things where it would take a year of CPU time to do the computation, and then by golly, you got the right answer at the end of it. And that was sort of a spectacular thing in the history of physics that really became clear in the, I would say, 1950s. There was this whole issue of renormalization and these infinities in physics that were sort of worked around in mathematical ways. But what really had happened there was that there was sort of this search for the fundamental stuff of the universe and the sort of fundamental physics, and that had a variety of different directions by after discovery of atoms. You know, they've been talked about by the Greeks, but they were really discovered at first by people like Dalton in the kind of chemistry area, by more like counting, you know, just seeing how things had to work in chemistry, and then more structurally when Brownian motion was discovered, and later on things like, you know, the nucleus was discovered by people like Rutherford in the early 1900s, and so on. And then there was this whole sort of zoo of particles, protons, neutrons, you know, electron had been discovered around 1900. Sort of it became clear that, yeah, you know, the atomists were right, everything was made of atoms type, you know, everything was made of particles. Of course, there were some notable exceptions, like space and time. When quantum mechanics first started coming out, it became clear that you know, all sorts of energy and angular momentum were quantized, and so the immediate assumption was space and time must be quantized as well, which didn't seem to be the case. Now, what had happened was, you know, Einstein in 1905 had come up with special relativity. Special relativity was a kind of a way of, it's very kind of almost a return to some previous sort of philosophical tradition of science, because the argument for special relativity is almost it's an argument by thought experiments and so on, based on the standard formalism of electrodynamics that had come in, that James Clerk Maxwell had developed in the late 1800s. And if you try and make that consistent with mechanics, then you end up with basically forcing the idea of special relativity, which is what Einstein did. But then it was found that the quantization of space and time didn't seem to be consistent with special relativity, and so that was sort of abandoned, and they were left as, well, Euclid was right, a point is that which has no part, and space and time are continuous, but all these other things are quantized. But then this whole zoo of particles started getting discovered, you know, the muon, the pion, the kaons, the sigma particles, the cascade hyperons, the, you know, all kinds of particles. So by 1960, there was just, as particle accelerators were coming online, there was just a zoo of more and more of these particles. Probably they reached maybe 50 particles by 1960, maybe 100, but pretty soon it was hundreds of particles. And so then, you know, questions arose like, well, what was the order of, you know, what was sort of the ordering principle of these particles? There were basically two theories. One theory was that, the original theory was one that came out of particularly Berkeley, California, was a democratic hypothesis that somehow all these particles were somehow equivalent and no particle was any more fundamental than any other particle. And this was, and so it was, it led to a thing called the bootstrap hypothesis, which was this, and it led to a very elaborate mathematical theory, S matrix theory, which was sort of turned into a big theory of of functions of many complex variables and so on, an attempt to sort of understand kind of how when particles scatter, they're represented by this S matrix, and that S matrix can be characterized mathematically in terms of various properties and things deduced from sort of constraints on the S matrix. So that was kind of one prevailing idea of how fundamental physics might work. The second prevailing idea that developed was the idea that, which was 1963 or 1964, the idea of quarks. Two people I both know well, Murray Gell-Mann and George Zweig, kind of came up with this idea in somewhat different ways that maybe all these particles could be accounted for if there just existed these things called quarks that were sort of more fundamental. You know, a proton is made of three of them, and a pion is made of a quark and an antiquark, and all this kind of thing. So people knew kind of combinatorially that this worked out, much as in the time of Dalton, people had known combinatorially that the idea of atoms would work out. But it wasn't known as that quarks as sort of real particles were a sensible idea until the early 1970s. And particularly, basically, experiments very much like the experiments Rutherford had done in scattering alpha particles off atoms, similarly scattering electrons off protons, had shown that there was sort of a hard bit inside protons that corresponded to quarks. I should mention that there were sort of previous theories even about what atoms were. I mean, so for example, back in the 1800s, there was sort of the question when electromagnetism was being developed, this idea arose from Maxwell and ultimately Hertz and people like that of electromagnetic waves. That you could get these sort of freely propagating electromagnetic waves, which were then realized to be, then radio was invented by thinking about those things, then it was realized that light was an example of an electromagnetic wave. The question is, how did electromagnetic waves work? And other waves people knew about, like water waves and sound waves, they had a medium that they operated in. So there was this, you know, just like sound waves are compression waves in air. So the question was, what were electromagnetic waves waves in, okay? And they were thought to be waves in the so-called luminiferous ether. So there was this notion of the ether, which was this sort of thing that sort of existed throughout space that was the carrier of electromagnetic waves. Well, then around 1900, the Michelson-Morley experiment looked for the ether drift, where as the Earth goes around the sun, you should expect to see sort of a shift in things because of its traveling through the ether. And none was found. And so that was what kind of led to things like relativity. Actually, it was kind of fun. Kelvin, Lord Kelvin, William Thomson, had this kind of cute idea in the late 1800s that maybe atoms were knots in the ether. And so he actually had a friend, Maxwell was also in on this idea. He had a friend who classified knots, a chap called Tait, who made up the sort of standard classification system of knots. And it really looked for a while like, gosh, there might be, you know, 90 kinds of knots and there were 90 kinds of atoms. And it would be sort of a wonderful thing if atoms were these sort of topological excitations in effect in the ether. Strangely, some of my own ideas about networks being sort of what's underneath space and time and that particles correspond to sort of features of this network are not that different from Kelvin's idea that atoms are knots in the ether. But never mind that. Having discovered that there was no ether drift and there's no ether in the universe, then in 1964, the cosmic microwave background was discovered. And in more recent years, it's discovered that, by golly, we are in fact moving at a thousandth of the speed of light relative to the cosmic microwave background. So there is an ether drift, in fact. And there is, in fact, a preferred frame in the universe, which is the rest frame of the cosmic microwave background. So in a typical thing of science, just like I was mentioning, you know, even though, even though epicycles were sort of thrown away, we use epicycles to compute things. And even though, you know, it's a little bit not as you might think that science advances in these kind of things where everything gets, you know, where the idea was just totally wrong. It's kind of like we're back having something very much like an ether, although its detailed operation is somewhat different. But in any case, the tradition, so by the by the 1970s, there's sort of the golden age of particle physics when it became clear that you could compute all kinds of things in QCD, theory of strong interactions and so on, and a bunch of other places. But still, there was this sort of dichotomy of the physicists believed that sort of the mathematics would save everything, and there was very elaborate mathematics, and the mathematics worked and allowed one to compute all kinds of things. And then there was this kind of computation area. Computation as a field was not a particularly big field. I mean, there were not very many computation theorists, and it was, you know, Turing machines. Most people hadn't probably never heard of Turing machines. Alan Turing as a person was not well known. So when I started getting involved in this stuff in the late 70s, kind of the notion that sort of the computation and physics were really fairly far apart. The only things that had been done were things like von Neumann had believed that computation necessarily dissipated heat, that every time you did a computation, it was a thermodynamic process. It became clear that you could do reversible computation, which is now what all the quantum computation stuff of today is based on, reversible computation, where instead of having two bits going into an AND operation and one bit comes out, which means you lose information, it has two bits go in and two bits come out. So that was, you know, there've been things like that. There was a whole, but this notion that kind of computation, that the whole, that kind of one should think about the universe in computational terms, and even the notion that kind of Turing computability, things computed by Turing machines might actually be the only thing you can do in our whole universe, really wasn't there until the early 1980s. And I think I was probably more responsible than I might think for having really pushed that idea. Of course, one has to realize that in principle, there may be things in the universe that the universe could perfectly well operate in a way that is hyper-computational, so to speak. I mean, there are plenty of things that Turing machines can't do. Like if you give a Turing machine a halting problem, you say, will this Turing machine ever halt? That's like saying, is there a finite size proof of this statement in for Gödel's theorem and so on? And all these things there are plenty of things which you can't reach from kind of the Turing machine model. But this is one of the questions that exists today, is whether sort of fundamental physics turns out to be something that can be done in computable form as in terms of things that are like Turing machines, or whether something beyond that is needed. And from sort of a theoretical point of view, something one can talk about, one can imagine things that go beyond what Turing machines do, but one suspects that in the actual universe, one can't construct things that go beyond that. But I suppose in, you know, kind of looking back on this whole sort of arc of sort of development of things, I mean, I think the thing that the sort of increasing formalization of stuff, the increasing abstraction, the increasing kind of use of kind of symbolic representations of things has certainly been a trend throughout history. It's kind of a funny thing that, you know, mathematics has kind of won out as this thing that everybody's taught and people think about mathematical thinking. You know, logic, for example, definitely lost out. I mean, in the Middle Ages, people would teach logic alongside teaching mathematics, and they were sort of equivalent. Logic was used as a particularly a way for people to think about formulating arguments and so on. It was taught in a kind of wacky way. There was the syllogistic logic, and people would learn these patterns of argument, and they had mnemonics. Like the two most famous were called Barbara and Celerant, which were these two kind of forms of argument that went according to particular, you know, they were like all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal type thing. That's a type of syllogism. People would learn these patterns of syllogistic logic. It's an interesting feature of history that as a thing that is generally taught to people, logic lost out, mathematics won, and that's kind of what led to, to be fair, that was sort of what, because computers were a late entrant on the scene, mathematics was well developed by the time computers arrived. And many things that, you know, could history have been different? Could it have been the other way around? Probably. Could cellular automata have been studied in the 1600s? Absolutely. The fact is that I think, you know, had the work of Leibniz been followed up, had people worked out had kind of discrete mathematics and the sort of computational idea been developed. There are many sort of accidents of history, I think, that led to the fact that the kind of continuous mathematical approach to things became as well developed as it did, and that one didn't have a more fundamentally computational view of the world. I mean, I think that the sort of the trend of mathematics can explain everything is a trend that one can see many steps in its development. I mean, from Pythagoras through to people like Leonardo da Vinci, who was not a particularly mathematical person, but who sort of had this belief that mathematics was the kind of gold standard for understanding the world. That was generally, I think that mathematics was complicated and people didn't understand it very well, was kind of one of the things that helped it in being thought of as the kind of gold standard for understanding stuff. People did comment that, for example, biological forms were not well modeled by mathematical ideas. As a guy called Darcy Wentworth Thompson, who wrote a book in 1917 called On Growth and Form, which was a strange kind of it had its foot in Aristotle and its foot in kind of mathematics. And it's a funny book. I mean, Darcy Thompson was sort of a traditional Victorian scholar, lived in Scotland. Actually, I was about to do kind of a biographical study of him because it's the centenary of his book. But he was a kind of classical scholar, and he wrote one of his books was about Greek birds, another one was about Greek fishes, identifying which fishes and birds were talked about in the works of the Greek authors and so on. But anyway, then he did a translation of Aristotle, actually. And then he wrote this book called On Growth and Form, which was an attempt to sort of bring mathematical and physical ideas and bring them together with, but he had a very Aristotelian approach, and a lot of it was very much of a work of philosophy, not very connected to and he has a very strange thing about the shapes of fishes, where he shows, actually it turns out his daughter wrote a biography of him and explained that he'd had this game, sort of party trick for kids, where he drew a picture of a dog on a rubber sheet and then he would stretch it in different directions and it would look like different breeds of dog. So that turned into his thing with fishes, which might have been kind of conformal transformations, might have been some whole theory of growth, but actually is pretty arbitrary and not clear what on earth it means. But it looks cool. That led to a tradition, actually, of mathematical biology. Well, I don't know the tradition, but there were various sort of moments where people tried to apply mathematics to biology, biology was, Turing, for example, in 1952, was interested in kind of, could you make, kind of came up with this idea of reaction diffusion equations as a way of explaining pigmentation patterns. There's this paper where he talks about, consider a spherical cow, and then considers the dappling pattern on the cow, and it ends up with his work on reaction diffusion equations was largely forgotten for a long time. It was also strange that for Turing himself, he had invented Turing machines, but Turing was very much of a small projects guy. So he did Turing machines. Within a year, he was onto something else, and then he was onto something else. He never thought Turing machines were particularly significant. He didn't really realize how universal what he discovered actually was. And then later on, when he was working on biology, 20 years later, 15 years later even, he really didn't think about Turing machines. So he said, oh, it's a physics-like system. We'll go back to differential equations to model biology. So he didn't really make that connection. And then he died in 1954. So I think it's... all these various, these things that I've investigated in NKS and kind of exploring the computational universe, they have all sorts of fun antecedents. I mean, people almost discovered all this stuff a zillion times. And the main reason they didn't, which is a cautionary tale for everything one thinks about, is they didn't have the bigger picture of what might be there. And so, for example, people knew that the distribution of primes was kind of random. That was Riemann studied lots of stuff about primes, but what people really studied was the regularity of the distribution of primes, and the Riemann hypothesis about the zeta function is basically a statement that the primes are kind of random, but it's not viewed as, but one is not grooving on the randomness of the primes, one is kind of grooving on the regularity of the randomness of the primes. And that was the tradition of mathematics, was to do these things where one could prove theorems about them. But that was a that was the thing where there have been the primes. The primes were known, all the way back in antiquity. I mean, Plato knew about primes. Pythagoras knew about primes. It's kind of an interesting, it's an interesting piece of the history of thought that, Pythagoras thought about primes and he thought about perfect numbers. And he was at least as interested in perfect numbers, if not more so, than his interest in primes. Yet, whoever cares about perfect numbers? Yet there's been this huge tower of mathematics that's been built on top of primes. But in any case, there were things like that. There were people who studied kind of rules for making things. There were people who had, there were fractal mosaic patterns that were made around 1210 AD by a particular guy in the Cosmati family of mosaic layers. That particular guy died a few years later, and that particular idea of like fractals was lost for 800 years, basically. Then reemerged with people like Benoit Mandelbrot and Cantor and so on. So then there'd been, well, for example, early neural networks. The people had made electrical systems that were supposed to be, little neural networks. And they showed kind of random behavior. And people said, oh, what a big nuisance, they're showing kind of random behavior. We really want them to show regular behavior. Same thing happened when people started doing, people had two-dimensional cellular automata were studied, not under that name, for optical character recognition in the 1950s. People were doing the equivalent of 2D cellular automata, and they found all kinds of sort of randomness in those things. They're like, oh, that's a big nuisance. We don't want to look at that. We just want to look at the regularity of what was going on. People found the idea of pseudo-random numbers came about in the 1940s. People had, another thing that happened, people knew that the digits of pi were kind of random. And people had tried in the 1800s, people had tried to prove things about the randomness of the digits of pi, like that they're an equal number of every digit that occurred. That's never been proved. But again, nobody was really thinking about this notion that from a simple rule about the creation of pi, you could get all of this complexity. That just wasn't something that was being thought about. And so when it came to the natural world and whether that was something relevant to the natural world, that just didn't kind of occur. That wasn't part of the kind of lexicon of what people thought about. And there were many other, a bunch of other kind of near miss types of things where people studied. I mean, in fact, even cellular automata was studied for cryptography purposes. Some of that I don't know about. It's still probably classified. There were things that were studied even about one-dimensional cellular automata, actually, in the late 1950s. Actually, some of what was studied about them became the thing called DES, the Data Encryption Standard, which was for a long time before the modern period of cryptography. That was kind of the going kind of thing. Anyway, so lots of stuff to say about the twists and turns of that history. I think that's my attempt to kind of survey the complete history of science, so to speak. I'm not sure I have forgotten many things. One thing I might mention about biology was in biology, sort of 1953 was kind of watershed year, because biology is a very complicated area. And particularly genetics, it was amazingly complicated. Mendelian inheritance, somewhat understood, but genetics was just this really complicated area. And then when sort of digital information, DNA and the way to encode digital information was discovered, that kind of greatly simplified what had been this immensely complicated set of stories about biology. And of course, biology in the time since then hasn't really had the same kind of organizing principle again. People have often said to me, theoretical biology types, have said to me sort of that there has to be some sort of NKS-based organizing principle of biology that will let one sort of qualitatively understand what happens in aging and what happens in other kinds of, what the meta-architecture of biology is. But that's still not clear. And at this point, we're in biology, it's really an area of just empirical fact. I mean, there's a famous statement of Ernest Rutherford, right? Of science consists of physics and stamp collecting, by which he meant, in physics, we get to figure things out. We have, methods of deducing what's true. in other areas, particularly chemistry, I think he was attacking at the time because biology wasn't really a big field at the time, is just stamp collecting in the sense that just all these random facts that that exist. Now, with what we understand today with computational irreducibility and things like that, there's actually a reason for this, which is the random facts of chemistry are random because they are like, you know, solutions of Diophantine equations or whatever. They are things that are sort of computationally irreducible. They're not things that can be deduced by sort of the derivation that one can make there. So in any case, and I'm probably forgetting a bunch of other interesting areas of science that where things have happened. I mean, you know, the social sciences remain, you know, social physics never happened. Although it was sort of the basis of a number of political movements, which kind of went sort of in the we can figure out everything type direction, and usually ended poorly. I think that the attempt, sort of the what mathematicization has been done in sort of economic areas, has led to the whole quant business and finance and so on. But it's certainly an incomplete area, and it's certainly notable at this time that, you know, you look at the curves you get from sort of watching web analytics, and you know, you have terabytes of data, and you can see what's going on. You compare those curves with the curves that you get in particle physics or something, looking at the behavior of particles, and the curves you get in web analytics of all sorts of, you know, random humans typing on keyboards are much smoother and more regular than the curves you get in physics typically. So there is some theory there probably, but we don't know what it is. And there's sort of a, you know, the insofar as there was sort of a Newton idea in that sort of was an organizing idea for physics, there has been no similar organizing idea for sort of the laws of human behavior that we certainly see empirical evidence of, but we don't have sort of the big picture of that. And it feels to us right now that there can't be a big picture, but that's how it always feels before you figure it out. It's like all of these areas, when there's some kind of unifying principle, you kind of have to have this conceptual framework for figuring stuff out that usually takes sort of a lot of development of a lot of kind of, you know, methodological development and sort of mechanical progress in these areas before you figure out sort of the next platform of understanding.
You've been listening to part 3 of a 4-part series on the history of science with Stephen Wolfram. Tune into the next episode where Stephen answers questions from students at the Wolfram Summer School about reductionism, cybernetics, the simulation hypothesis, and a new kind of science. Next time on the Stephen Wolfram Podcast. For more information on Stephen's blog posts, books, live coding streams, and podcasts, visit stephenwolfram.com.